Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. President Trump on Wednesday cut short a meeting with Democratic congressional leaders, saying that he will not work with them on legislation until they stop investigating him and his administration. President Trump blamed House Speaker Nancy Pelosi for his early exit after just 3 minutes, pointing to Pelosi's remarks about him earlier in the day. Here she is.
We do believe that it's important for to follow the facts. We believe that no one is above the law, including the President of the United States. And we believe that the President of the United States is engaged in a cover-up, in a cover-up.
Joining us to share his insights is political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. Welcome back, Ken.
Thank you, Ann.
So, you know, some people, I guess, have called it sort of an ambush that the president pulled by just showing up to the meeting, not sitting down, leaving after 3 minutes, and then going to the lectern in the Rose Garden with the sign on it, no collusion, etc. But it sounds like Speaker Pelosi was playing a little politics herself.
Well, look, whenever you talk about impeachment, a lot of it is politics, and a lot of it is, of course, about 2020. But the fact that there was already a sign attached to that lectern in the Rose Garden made it seem to be proof to everybody that this was just going to be a show meeting by the president. He was already planning to go out to the Rose Garden and address reporters who were already out there, and that's exactly what happened.
She said her caucus is calling for impeachment hearings, but she feels differently. She's still yesterday, it sounded like she was sketchy on the idea. Why do you think? What is she saying?
She's in a tough position because there are at least 25 members of her Democratic caucus who are already saying that we must have impeachment. And while Nancy Pelosi may feel that that's not a bad idea, and she's talking about the president has been involved in a cover-up, she also knows that impeachment, or at least removal of the president from office, is certainly doomed in a Republican-controlled Senate. But at the same time, I think what she wants to do, what Nancy Pelosi wants to do, is let the courts do its thing. In other words, there are still court, there are subpoenas out, mm-hmm. to, like, for example, the president's accounting firm, the president's bank, people who have been giving him, loaning him money for decades. They've been handling his tax returns. There was a bill passed in the New York State Legislature that allows Congress to get the president's state, New York State, tax returns. So I think what she is doing, what Nancy Pelosi is doing, is rather than jump into impeachment at all costs right away, let's see what they can get, what kind of information they get. And if they can't get information, first of all, if they get damaging information, then of course there's almost no recourse other than to have an impeachment inquiry. But if they don't get information and the president insists on keeping people like Don McGahn, the former White House counsel, or Bill Barr, the attorney general, from testifying, that could be another reason for opening up an impeachment inquiry.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking politics this hour with a political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The president has said that he won't work on legislation with Democrats until they end the investigations. And I'm wondering, how practical is that in the year before the next presidential election when nothing will get done?
Well, I think that's the big point. In these times, nothing seems to get done as we're approaching an election. Of course, there's always an election that's approaching, and therefore that's why a lot of things don't get done. So obviously, for the president to say, I'm not going to work with the Democratic House at all until these investigations stop, well, they're not going to stop. Kamala Harris was on Colbert last night, and she said, well, of course it's not going to stop. This is what we have to do. And of course, as Nancy Pelosi said, we can still have investigations and still work with the president on the things that the country desperately needs, like an infrastructure bill. But, you know, we've been talking infrastructure bill for 2 years now, even before investigations started, and nothing has started with the infrastructure as well. And the fact is, if we're talking about $2 trillion bill, well, who pays for it and how does it get paid? Nobody seems to have an answer for that either.
I don't know if it was Chuck Schumer, the Senate Democratic leader in the Senate, or who said that they thought that Donald Trump doesn't have a resolution to that issue of funding for the $2 trillion infrastructure proposal, and that he walked out of the meeting prematurely because he really doesn't have a solution to the problem.
Well, he knew he didn't have a solution to the problem even before he walked in the meeting.
Right.
And they've been talking about infrastructure, as I said, for 2 years
right.
now, and nobody's coming any closer. Look, it's the kind of bill that one would think that both sides can agree on. It's not, you know, there's not a Democratic way or a Republican way of building bridges or improving roads. So one would think that's an easy thing for the two parties to agree with. Mm-hmm. But with the deficit growing as fast as it is, given the fact that with the tax cuts and things like that and other things that the president and the Republican Congress is pushing, there's really no path for the money to pay for this infrastructure bill. And so there really is no plan other than the fact that it sounds good on paper.
So it's unlikely the Democrats will move forward in the House on anything either.
Well, I mean, you can't do anything. I mean, look, the Democrats have passed many bills on many things, including guns and environment and clean air and things like that, that either don't see the light of day in the Senate or knocked down in the Senate. So, you know, it's one thing for Nancy Pelosi to say, here's what we've passed in the House, and that's fine and dandy. But until the Senate goes along with it, until the president signs it, nothing is really happening. And that's certainly going to be the case in the year and a half we have until the next election. I'm laughing because this is going to be the longest year and a half of our lives, I think.
You know, I got to ask you. I mean, you've been around the block a few times.
Thank you very much. Thank
you're
you
very,
for
very
that
welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah. You're a veteran political journalist, but as anything,
I've
been covering politics for 30 years, and I'm pretty exhausted. What about you? How you holding up?
Well, you know something. I'm for some reason. I'm holding up well, only because every time I see we've never seen this before. I mean, you know, look, this is a very exciting election. This is probably the most, we always say this, but this could be one of the most consequential elections of our lifetime. And I've been a political junkie since at least the 68 election, and that was the most important political, you know, presidential election in our lifetime. So we keep moving the bar, but it keeps getting more and more important. But we're also seeing history in the making. If you're looking at the 9,424 Democrats who are already running for president, you're just seeing I think somebody else just entered, so that number may change. But it's just remarkable to see who is running. You know, when you think of 2000, it was Al Gore and it was Bill Bradley, and that was it.
Uh-huh.
Or in 2016, it was Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders and maybe Martin O'Malley and a few others. But this is, the number is 23 and counting.
Yeah.
And you have a debate coming up, you know, at the end of June, where you have a maximum of 20 Democrats on the stage. People roll their eyes, and of course, late night comics have a lot of fun with this, but this is a very significant and impressive Democratic field, and we'll just, you know, look, politics in this country is changing, and we'll just see if it changes through the 2020 election.
Ray in Garfield Heights, you're on the air with Ken Rudin. Hi, Ray.
Hi, guys. Ken, I was just wondering if you see any correlation or comparison to what they're digging into with President Trump as far as taxes and tax returns, what might be on them, might not be on them, and maybe hiding money overseas and stuff. Any comparison to what they did with organized crime gangsters in the 30s, where they really didn't get them sometimes on violent crimes or stuff like that, but they went after them for tax evasion and kind of nailed them on that?
Well, I'm smiling, Ray, because, I mean, basically, we've just put Donald Trump and Al Capone in the same sentence. But you're exactly right. They did not get Al Capone on the murders or the crime. They got him on tax evasion. And, of course, we saw tremendous congressional testimony in the 1950s about organized crime, the famous Kefauver Commission, where they investigated, you know, the Jimmy Hoffas of the world and the other crime bosses in around the country, and that got a lot of attention. But there are a lot of questions, legitimate questions, that have never been answered about Donald Trump. And, you know, you go back to 1973. Every president since 1973 has released his tax returns. And not only do we not have that from the president, but we don't know about his business interests. The fact that the president owns a hotel just blocks away from the White House where foreign dignitaries are staying all the time. It sounds like there may be some kind of an interesting conflict there, but we don't know. And so there are a lot of questions. I think that's what a lot of people don't understand about Nancy Pelosi. They say, why haven't we had an impeachment hearing yesterday? Why didn't it start yesterday? She knows that there are a lot of investigations going out, a lot of subpoenas for actual documents. And when and if those documents see the light of day, then I think it'll be much clearer whether the president has been obstructing justice, whether there is a cause for impeachment. And I think that's what's holding Nancy Pelosi back. But she's very aggressive behind the scenes trying to get this information.
Alex in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Alex.
Hello. Thank you, Ken, for being on the show. I really appreciate the time and attention that you put to it. I wanted to ask about the technicalities of impeachment. Aren't there articles of impeachment, almost like in the Declaration of Independence, where there's specific articles or specific charges, and it's built into one single legal case? Is that correct?
Well, I mean, look, when you think of the Richard Nixon impeachment in 1974 with the House Judiciary Committee, I mean, ultimately, it all falls on the umbrella with an R, that's my Bronx accent, the umbrella of high crimes and misdemeanors. So you could have obstruction of justice, you could have lying to Congress, you could have, collusion you can have with a foreign power. So there's no boilerplate on an impeachment, but before they even write up articles of impeachment, they need to see exactly what's going on. And that's why these subpoenas of the banks and the fact that federal courts are supporting Congress and opposing the president are so important.
Alex, thanks a lot for that call. And then Iris in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Iris.
Hi. I've been looking forward to this show all week. Believe me, it's worth every penny that I donate to WOSU. Oh, donate, people, donate. Now, about this.
I love Iris.
You talked about Mr. Trump and Ms. Pelosi not passing laws. But Mr. McConnell's got a big part in there, and he is not doing his job. Would you please speak to that? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you. Donate, people. Bye.
Thanks, Iris. What about Mitch McConnell's role in all of this? He's been kind of quiet lately.
Can I just say I loved Iris' call?
I love Iris,
every
too.
Word
checks
of it.
In the mail, Iris.
I know. I want her picture on my website. Right. But she's absolutely right, and I mentioned that earlier, that for all the things that the House is passing, as I said, on clean air and guns and things like that, well, the Mitch McConnell will not let it see the light of day. Mitch McConnell knows that he's not going to allow anything to come before the Senate if the president is opposed to it. I mean, that's what he does. I mean, we saw with his deft handling, or some people say his horrific handling of Merrick Garland, that if he wants something to happen, he'll make it happen. And if he doesn't, he'll fight it tooth and nail. And so all the things that it's very nice that all these new Democrats who were elected in 2018 and they promised all these things and they're going to have this, make this happen and that happen on guns and abortion and clean air and things like that. But McConnell just blocks it. I mean, we used to make jokes about Jesse Helms. He used to call him Senator No, the senator from North Carolina, who always would block legislation he didn't want. But that's exactly what's become in the Republican Senate. And that's why the battle for the Senate in 2020 is in many ways even more important than the battle for the presidency, because you can have a Democratic president, which is fine and dandy for Democrats. But if you have Mitch McConnell blocking, Supreme Court nominations or blocking any kind of legislation because of the arcane rules of the Senate, you're not gaining much. So as important as the battle for the presidency is, the battle for the Senate is extremely important. And right now, I mean, I would have to say that the Republicans are favored to keep control of the Senate after 2020, but those battles in the Senate are so, so crucial.
We are going to continue our conversation. Lots to talk about with Ken Rudin, political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
In WOSU Public Media's newest podcast series, Rivet, young people share their unique pathways to professional success. Listen to This American Graduate Project. Find Rivet now in WOSU's mobile app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Congressional Democrats are a step closer to getting President Trump's tax returns. New York state lawmakers have passed a bill that would allow state tax officials to release those returns to any one of three congressional committees. The decision comes as a judge in Manhattan rules against the president in his effort to block Deutsche Bank from complying with congressional subpoenas. We're talking politics this hour with national political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. Ken, I wanted to go back to Mitch McConnell for a second. Is there anything as far as going with Supreme Court appointments, if one should pop up in 2020, as it did in 2016, early 2016, he said that during an election year, there shouldn't be that kind of change on the court, and they held off. You mentioned the Merrick Garland case earlier. He was President Obama's nominee to the court and was not even interviewed by the Senate panel. What about
never got a hearing?
Never got a hearing. What about it this time around? What if something blows and do you think he'll stand by that they won't appoint anybody or they won't?
Of course not. I mean, they did an argument similar, not really, but similar to what happened in 1968 when Abe Fortas when Earl Warren resigned for the Supreme Court and Lyndon Johnson wanted to put Abe Fortas on the court, and a lot of Republicans and Southern Democrats put up a filibuster, and basically they felt that Lyndon Johnson was a lame duck president, and therefore we want a new it should be up to a new president to have his or her own Supreme Court justice. So I mean, look, obviously, if something happened in 2020 that would call for an opening in a Supreme Court and call for confirmation of a new justice, of course, you know, what was said in 2016 won't win it. Just like, I mean, for example, all these conservatives who are saying that, you know, what Barack Obama did with his executive orders and all those things are so unconstitutional, and they, you know, would do everything they could to stop it. When Donald Trump does the same executive orders, they are very silent about it. So it always depends. It all depends on who's in the White House and who controls the Senate. So if there were a vacancy or an opening in the Supreme Court, you know that the fact that it's 2020 won't stop the Republican Senate from holding hearings.
I'm just still wondering about the politics of that.
Well, you know something, that's a good question. I thought the Republicans would pay the price in 2016 for blocking Merrick Garland from the court.
True.
After, you know, Scalia died, but they didn't. They didn't. And the fact is, as a matter of fact, in 2018, they gained seats in the Senate because of, you know, liberal Democrats or so-called liberal Democrats in North Dakota and Missouri and Indiana and Florida. So, I mean, you know, it's like the government shutdowns. Every time there's a government shutdown, they say, wow, that party is going to pay the political price. Mm-hmm. When the Republicans shut down the government in 2013, everybody said, oh, that's the end for the Republicans. And then in 2014, they had tremendous gains in the House and Senate. So I think voters' memories are short-term, and mm-hmm. they seem to forget. But there's a lot of issues other than a Supreme Court nomination that are at stake in the 2020 election, that's for sure.
Michigan Republican Congressman Justin Amash has risked his political future by calling for President Trump's impeachment. You know, and right away, the president started pushback.
He's a loser.
Yeah, he's a loser.
He's a loser. He's a loser. He's a lightweight. He never votes with the Republican Party. The fact is, Justin Amash is one of those Tea Party true believers, you know, the Freedom Caucus, true believers. And he was, Justin Amash is who I was thinking of a few minutes ago. And he said, look, if we didn't like the kind of unconstitutional things that Barack Obama did, and of course he was very vocal during that, we should feel exactly the same way about what Donald Trump does, and the Republican Party doesn't seem to agree with him. So Justin Amash is the only Republican, House or Senate, who has called for the impeachment of the president. He said that what Attorney General Bill Barr did with the Mueller report was just his own skewed interpretation of it, and it didn't conform with reality. But of course, Amash, who it's a very solidly Republican district in Western Michigan, but at the same time, he could be subject to a primary, which is very possible. You know that any time a Republican comes out against Trump, be it Mark Sanford of South Carolina or Jeff Flake of Arizona, they pay the price. Either their political future is doomed, or they lose in the primary. And Justin Amash has basically put the bullseye on his back. Now, there's a lot of talk of Amash running as the Libertarian Party candidate for president in 2020. And while the Libertarians never get more than 2 or 3% ever, he could do what Ralph Nader did to Al Gore in Florida, you know, in Michigan, certainly one of the few states that, that Donald Trump won as in a surprise in 2016. It could jeopardize Trump in Michigan in 2020.
So are you thinking the threat would be to Trump, not to any Democratic nominee?
I'm sorry, say that again?
The threat would be to Trump, not any Democratic nominee or not to the independent sector of voters or that kind of a thing.
Oh, no, I think if he does run. But it's very interesting. The fact that Justin Amash says Trump should be impeached, and Nancy Pelosi hasn't said that yet. Now, of course, we described earlier what Nancy Pelosi is all about, but you know, think of all these other critics, even the few of them there are, like Mitt Romney. Nobody is stepping forward and saying, Justin Amash, we're right behind you. So it's kind of remarkable. Until the Republican Party, until more members of the Republican Party start talking about impeachment, and that's perhaps unlikely, we're not likely to get the kind of bipartisan calls for impeachment that we had with Nixon. Remember Bill Cohn and Larry Hogan and Barry Goldwater and Hugh Scott and other Bob Griffin of Michigan, other, I'm mentioning these names out of the past, but they were Republicans who stood up in 1974 and said, enough is enough with the Nixon extracurricular activities. They're not doing that. Justin Amash is a very lonely voice in a Republican dominated capital.
And you know, he came aboard, as you mentioned, during the Tea Party era. He said that recently, the Tea Party members aren't as interested in limited government as they had said they would be. Instead, they lost steam after Obama left office. And I'm wondering, what do you think about the Tea Party caucus in Congress, and who are they? What are they doing?
Well, I mean, they probably forced Paul Ryan out of the speakership. I mean, of course, the Republicans lost control of the House, but John Boehner and Paul Ryan had more problems with their own conservative Freedom Caucus members than they did with the Democrats. They feel that, but Justin Amash made a very good point that all this constitutional talk that the Republicans were giving during the Obama presidency that seemed to end on January 20th, 2017, when Donald Trump came into office. It's remarkable how compliant many Republicans have been when they, for the longest time, they stood for, you know, constitutional law and limited government and free trade, all these things that Donald Trump has upended, and yet there's very little complaint. And if you do complain, you jeopardize your political future.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking politics with political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie.
Huh? Veteran. Veteran. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Old man. not a bit.
You know, I remember.
If I had your memory, with your kind of memory, with your recall and everything, my God, you're like a spring chicken.
No, I have a great memory, Alice.
Gosh, you're lucky. Yeah. Joanne in Columbus, you're on the air with Ken Rudin. Welcome, Joanne.
Hi. I just want to make a comment that Merrick Garland is going to be the judge who decides this New York case against Trump.
Well, this is a great story. I mean, I love this story. Basically, Donald Trump, the Trump people and the Republicans have tried to quash a subpoena to get tax records from one of his, like, I think it's either Deutsche Bank or his accounting firm. So Trump appealed it, and it's going to a U.S. Court of Appeals court in Washington, and the head judge there is Merrick Garland. Now, the irony of that is delicious, but two things. First of all, there's no guarantee that Garland will be the judge to hear this case, and to his credit, Merrick Garland is not somebody who's going to, you know, remember think of political slights when he hears a case, but the high integrity that both Democrats and Republicans have always said about Merrick Garland will come to the forefront if he does hear that case. But just the thought of Merrick Garland being the decider of whether Donald Trump's tax returns sees the day light of day is kind of delicious, shall we say.
Yeah, it's interesting. Joanne, thanks for that call. Anybody else? The number is 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org.
Don't we want to hear from Iris again?
Yeah, I know. Iris, where
are
you?
It's been a long time since Iris said some nice things. Can I just say one thing also that talking about the delicious irony, did mm-hmm. anybody see Ben Carson the other day testify before the House Financial Services Committee? This was remarkable. I mean, this is the guy. I mean, he was asked basically about a basic question about home mortgages and businesses and lenders, and Congresswoman Porter of California asked him about REOs, and basically Ben Carson said, "Are you asking about Oreos?" You know, like he thought he's never heard this term before.
Right.
Like, I mean, this is basic language that somebody who's the head of HUD, the secretary of HUD, should know about. Now, even later, which was startling, when Ben Carson was asked, what does he think about HUD? He said, I thought Paul Newman was a great actor. So I thought that was, no, I made that up.
He was, no, but that was a joke, but.
Yes, I made
that
up.
Yeah.
But everything else really happened.
Yeah, it really did happen. And I'm wondering about his hearing.
What?
Something as banal as his hearing.
No, I'm kidding. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, I know. I always fall for that one. I always fall for that one.
I know. It's always easy to do it on the radio. But I don't even think it's his hearing. I really think that, look, he's a brilliant surgeon, but he had no business being appointed Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. And I just don't think he's engaged. But I don't know. It's just kind of sad. He's not a bad guy. He's just in the wrong person for this job, but that's the case with a lot of appointees.
There are more interims now, aren't there?
True, right. A lot of acting lack there, but Bessie DeVos is still there, and she's still taking heat, and other members of the cabinet who are not experts in the field that they're supposed to be heading up.
The president can't appeal all these court rulings regarding the financial records. He says he'll take this fight all the way to the Supreme Court. Is that the trajectory for something like this once the state gets involved? Once a state like the state of New York gets involved?
I don't think so. I mean, look, certainly that the president will try to run out the clock and delay court procedures as long as he can, certainly past the 2020 election. Mm-hmm. But But not everything goes to the Supreme Court, and I have a feeling it's very possible that the Supreme Court, I mean, we should talk about abortion, which will go to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
But right now, these kind of cases, I think, will be settled by these federal courts that are ruling on whether the president can ignore the subpoena or not. And I don't think those make it to the light of day at the Supreme Court.
Well, speaking of abortion, Roe v. Wade, it's been 46 years. It's still top of mind. Has it always been so critical in politics?
Well, you know something, that's a great question. I think one of the reasons it seems to be more on everybody's mind now than ever before is that you probably have, for the first time, we thought this was the case earlier, but it's probably the first time we have a Supreme Court that looks like it's ready to overturn the Roe decision from 1973, with the addition of the of Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh. It seems like the court, if it gets that far, could be ready to either overturn Roe or severely change Roe. But you have all these state laws, you know, I mean, everywhere between Ohio, they call it the heartbeat bill, but Ohio and Mississippi and Kentucky and Georgia, states that won't allow abortion after 8 weeks, after 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. The Alabama law refuses to allow abortion ever. I mean, at all, and plus the fact that that doctors who perform these procedures could be sentenced to 99 years in prison for doing so. Now, Roe allows this. The Supreme Court ruled in 1973 that women have this right to reproductive freedoms that these state courts are chopping down. So when you have a very conservative anti-abortion rights president in the White House and a Supreme Court that seems to be more conservative than ever, I think abortion rights advocates are more fearful than ever that if it does get to the court, if something gets to the court, it will not be good news for the Roe decision.
Mike and Bexley, you're on the air with Ken Rudin. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'd like to join the caller who said support WSU, and thanks to Ken Rudin for being a wonderful guest. I look forward to hearing him. I'm concerned about President Trump basically lying, but in particular right now, he's saying he's the most transparent president ever, and obviously he's covering up his obstruction and anything else? Would you comment on his transparency? Thank you.
Okay, so his assertion, thank you, Mike, that he is the most transparent president ever.
Well, you know something? There is something about Donald Trump when you watch him at an impromptu news conference, like when he comes before the cameras, when he leaves the White House, he does say things that he thinks. I mean, mm-hmm. I mean, whether it's whatever you think of it, he does. In that way, he, you know, people say that, well, there hasn't been many Sarah Huckabee Sanders White House press briefings, but Trump does address the press a lot, probably more so than Barack Obama did.
Yep.
And so we do hearing from him more than ever. But I mean, what Mike is getting to is the fact that so much of the president, I mean, he remember when he promised he would release his tax returns. He's under audit. Now they say absolutely not. So many promises that he'll release information. I mean, we should know. I mean, it's not a question of invasion of privacy. We should know if the president has some kind of financial dealings that benefits his family. How could the American people not know that? So for all the talk about transparency, and, you know, presidents do keep secrets, and every president does that at all, but I've never seen a president where we have so little information that could help us understand if he's benefiting from the presidency personally. I mean, remember Richard Nixon standing before the cameras, he said, I never took a dime, I am not a crook. Well, we don't know if the president is a crook, and I'm not saying he is a crook, but the fact that he's keeping all that information away from us is just the antithesis of what a democratic society should be all about.
Mike and Bexley, thanks for that call. We are talking with political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin, this hour about politics. So if you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Dan Fisher. We're talking about the conflicts between President Trump and congressional Democratic leaders and more today with political journalist and host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And I just want to turn right to Evan and Hilliard to pick up this thread again. Evan, you're on the air with Ken Rudin. Welcome.
Hey there. How y'all doing? We were talking about tax returns and how we think that politicians should be releasing our tax returns. And honestly, I'm not sure that's a great idea because you're going to have a bunch of people who want to run for office but don't want to release how they're making their money and all the weird stuff they might be doing. But also, the alternative is, do we want, like, the left is the one that's begging for this information, but is it Nancy Pelosi? Her salary is under $200,000 a year, yet she's probably valued at over $50 million. Where is she getting her money, and is she going to release her tax documents?
Ken Rudin?
Well, I mean, first of all, Nancy Pelosi is not running for president, but she is worth a lot. I know her husband is a very wealthy businessman, and he's had a lot of money for a long, long time. But it's interesting your point about the left and taxes, because Bernie Sanders, until this year, for the longest time, Bernie Sanders, especially in 2016, didn't release his tax returns either. And there was a lot of cry about, you know, what is he hiding and what is he, you know, what's his story too. Now, he has come around this time and has released several years worth of it. But not everybody does it. The fact is, I'm just comparing Trump to former presidents, Democrat and Republican, as I say, going back to 1973. They've always been open about it. And as president of the United States, I think there's some, I mean, look, you could talk about Nancy Pelosi, you could talk about many members of Congress, wealthy or not wealthy, but the President of the United States, somehow we should know these things. We should know if there are conflicts of interest, and if you don't release your tax returns, we'll never know it. But both parties do have secrets, both sides have people who would rather, both sides have candidates who would probably not want to release all their financial worth. But I think Nancy Pelosi's numbers are out there.
Yeah, it's pretty well known how wealthy she is and that a lot of it comes from her husband. Ed in Baltimore, you're on the air. Hi, Ed.
Yes, thank you. My question is, what does Ken think about the possibility of the Democrats going to court to challenge the theory of executive privilege on someone like Don McGahn, who's no longer in the administration? And secondarily, has that doctrine ever actually been challenged in the court? And I'll listen offline.
All right, Ed, thank you.
You know something? I like that question because I should have the answer to it, and I don't. But I've been thinking the same thing. It's one thing for the president to invoke executive, to keep members of the administration from testifying mm-hmm. or releasing conversations. But as Ed points out, Don McGahn is no longer part of the administration. He's a former White House counsel. He left the administration. I don't know why this doctrine would include like a Don McGahn or somebody who's left. And so I don't know the answer to it. And I don't know if there's ever been a challenge. I know, I think that, going back to Nixon again, I think he did invoke executive privilege during the White House tapes, and the Supreme Court overruled him. But I don't know what happens when you're talking about somebody who is no longer part of the administration. I don't know what powers the executive has over somebody who's no longer there. I don't know the answer, but it's a very good question.
Chris and Galena, you're on the air. Hi, Chris.
Hi, great topic. I'm with Iris Donate.
Oh.
And I love Ken Rudin. So So I have a question about Iran. A little scary over there, and Trump's surrounded by hawks. And he says he's not interested in going in. Where do you think Congress is going to come down on this?
Well, he's not interested in going in, but I saw today that they're sending 5,000 more troops to the Middle East. Ken Rudin, what do you think's going on?
Well, yeah, I think you knew something was wrong when Trump was moving all our warships to the Gulf of Tonkin. No, I'm kidding about that part. But it sounds like a lead up to what we saw in Vietnam in the early 60s. But here's the thing, though. Yes, we could say that Bolton, the National Security Advisor, is a real Iran hawk, which he is, and is pushing for war, which he seems to be doing, and Donald Trump is the peacenik in all this. But when Donald Trump says, if Iran does anything, it'll no longer be a country. It'll be blown out of the sky, which is basically what he said about North Korea until he sat down with Kim. Mm-hmm. So I'm a little nervous about the rhetoric, the freedom to just talk about, ending a country as we know it without negotiations. And the president seems to be dead set against any kind of rapprochement with Iran, which he has agreed to do with North Korea. But the rhetoric is very, very scary. And, it's one thing to have sanctions, and sanctions seem to be working. But when you're talking about, more and more troops and possible retaliation and ending Iran as we know it, look, I have no brief for the country of Iran and what it does in the world, but talking about war so casually just frightens me.
And then I wonder about the timing. He wants another 5,000 troops in the Middle East as a defensive measure, is what they're calling it. But what's your take on the timing of all of this?
Well,
it seems to come out of nowhere. It's unclear. I mean, obviously, there's been friction since they ended the pact over the nuclear pact. But
well, I mentioned Gulf of Tonkin as almost like a joke, but there have been numerous ships in the area that have been damaged by some kind of missiles or something, and a lot of speculation, or at least a speculation from the White House, that it's coming from Iran. So when you start talking about what Iran is doing and aggressive actions that Iran may or may not be taking, then you have talk about retaliation. It just seems, as I say, it's just such a haphazard conversation about, look, you don't want to go to war with anybody, but Iran and North Korea are the kind of regimes that you don't know what could happen to the rest of the world when didn't World War I break out out of an assassination that should have been localized and became a world war? You just don't know what's going to happen by any kind of talk about kind of confrontations. So I don't know. And before we go, because I know we're running out of time, but I'd love to, if we could get a chance to talk about the all the Democrats running for president.
Oh, because, yes, of course. Yeah.
Because they are trying desperately to make the cut for the June 26th and 27th Democratic debate in Miami. And not everybody will make it. They'll only have there's only 20 Democrats who will be allowed in the two night back to back nights. Only 20, right. Well, but the difference is with the Republicans in 2016, they had the kiddies table, like George Pataki and Carly Fiorina, candidates who weren't doing well in the polls on a separate night that nobody watched. But this one will be 10 one night, 10 the other night, and you have criteria that they have to make before they're accepted. And new big names who have gotten in the race, like Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York City, and Steve Bullock, the governor of Montana. Well, he's a beaut. Mm-hmm. And Michael Bennett, the senator from Colorado. I mean, they may not make the cut because you need to have a certain amount of donations, and you have to reach a certain number in polls. And not everybody's going to be on that stage. So,
but there'll be enough of them on stage.
Well, that's true. That's true. And you wonder if 45 seconds of talking is going to make a difference. But if you're not part of the conversation, it's very possible that some of these candidacies may not survive Iowa and New Hampshire next year.
So Bernie Sanders has gained on Joe Biden compared to last month, narrowing the lead by, I don't know, was it? It was double. Well, it's 24-27%, something like that before. Now it's down to 17 or 18% percentage points, I should say. What does it say? The two older white males are leading the pack, though.
Well, it says that really what's happening in May of 2019 really has not much to do with what's going to ultimately happen. I'm not saying that Joe Biden shouldn't be considered the front runner at this point, but remember Jeb Bush mm-hmm. was the Republican who was absolutely going to be the nominee in 2016. Hillary Clinton had, I mean, this Barack Obama guy, he was not going to be a threat to Hillary Clinton in 2008. So the polls are interesting now. It's interesting to see the people who jump up, like Pete Buttigieg. I mean, just, you know, he appears everywhere, and suddenly he's moving up in the polls. But mm-hmm. let's see what happens in the debate, and let's see what the folks of Iowa and New Hampshire mm-hmm. have to say. Remember, Joe Biden, the last time he ran for president, he did so poorly in the Iowa caucuses, he dropped out that night. Mm. Now, it's a different Joe Biden today. He's been vice president for 8 years, but is, you know, does he represent something in the Democratic Party that's no longer relevant? That's from a day that's long since passed. So we'll see what voters have to say. Look, there's a question of whether you want somebody who touches your progressive heart and mm-hmm. makes you, you know, shake with excitement, or do you want somebody who could beat Donald Trump? That's what the Democrats are wrestling with now. And I think that's what we'll see a lot of starting June 26 on that stage in Miami.
It's going to be a particular alchemy, you know, as far as the key to defeating Trump in 2020. And I kind of say it's a candidate that can light a fire in the belly of otherwise lackadaisical Democratic and independent voters and just get them out to the polls, either a candidate or an issue.
Look, after 2.5 years of what's going on now, the fact that there still may be lackadaisical mm-hmm. Democratic voters is shameful. I think there are, though. Well,
if they don't get their candidate, that was a function of the Bernie Sanders
That's true.
Effect.
Bernie Sanders, I mean, whatever you think about Bernie Sanders, a lot of his supporters were not excited about Hillary Clinton, neither was Bernie Sanders, and a lot of them either voted for Jill Stein or right. stayed home. And you know, you think of how the few votes that separated Clinton and Trump in Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. Turnout is key. I mean, it sounds like an old, you know, obvious slogan, but it is key for 2020.
There's been a story about how Biden is attracting a lot of big political donors for his campaign. Is there a different equation this time around? Could big money backfire on him?
It could if you listen to Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, who feel that, you know, the Republican Party is the party of wealthy donors and the Democratic Party is the party of the people. And you're absolutely right. Biden is getting big donations from big supporters, whereas Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren and others are getting $5, $10 and things like that. It's interesting, though, that when you go back to 2016, Hillary Clinton far outspent Donald Trump, far outraised Donald Trump, mm-hmm. and she lost. So, and remember, Jeb Bush had $100 million at this right. time in 2015. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you could talk about all the money you want, but yeah. somehow if you don't have a connection with voters, all the money in the world is not going to save you.
And Elizabeth, you know, whether it's Elizabeth Warren, Kamala Harris, Kirsten Gillibrand, you know, you name who it is. There is a lot more policy talk out there this time around than I remember from years past. It's not necessarily a thing they can get done, but they have their 15-point plans out there.
I agree with you, and that's certainly true about Elizabeth Warren, certainly true about Kamala Harris and others. But that's not true about Joe Biden, which is interesting. Joe Biden, I mean, again, it's still May of 2019, mm-hmm. but he seems to be talking more in overall desire to defeat Donald Trump, and yeah. I can do it. But he doesn't have the 15-point plan that, I mean, Kamala Harris just did something, I guess, this week about pay equality, which yeah. is a very important issue, and she's going to try to push it through the Senate. Lots of luck with pushing anything through the Senate
right.
from a Democrat. But the point is, this is what the Democrats are standing for. And not, you know, I don't know if look, you think of Elizabeth Warren and all the things she's pushing for, and you have a guy named, you know, Pete Buttigieg, who hasn't really said much of anything, and suddenly he's leading in the polls, and Elizabeth Warren is now in single digits.
Right.
I don't, the dynamic is very fascinating to watch. And again, it's still early.
It's crazy time. The next time we talk will be the Thursday before the first debate. Can't wait right. to forecast that. But in the meantime, Ken Rudin, thanks as always. Really appreciate it.
Next month, I'll be even more of a veteran.
He'll be in ages daily. Ken Rudin, political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Thanks to you. And thanks to everybody else for all your calls and for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.